Okay, 10 o'clock, we'll get started. Carrie, could you please take the roll?
Chair Treacock?
Here.
Vice Chair Carter? Regent Geddes?
Here.
Regent Hayes? Regent Perkins?
Here.
You have a quorum present. Advisory member, Mr. Campbell?
Here.
Thank you.
Okay, great. We'll go to agenda item number one, public comment. Carrie, do you have any public comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have one public comment submission from Taylor Valentine, Valentine. Good morning. My name is Taylor Valentine, and I'm a senior undergraduate student at the University of Nevada, Reno. This is the third investors meeting I've attended. I first came as a freshman with my fellow environmental club members to ask the committee to consider beginning to divest from fossil fuels. I attended again last September when the committee discussed possible divestment and our carbon neutrality plans and talked about sending a letter to the institutions for feedback. My fellow club members have now graduated, but I am still here to continue the movement they started. Climate issues are not going away and are more dire than ever. I ask the committee to make divestment a priority and demand further carbon neutrality initiatives. At the university, I study environmental policy and public health. In nearly every class I have taken, I've come face to face with the devastating effects of the fossil fuel industry. For the class I have in 2 hours, I'll be submitting a paper on how fossil fuel emissions contribute to rising rates of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and childhood asthma. In the next class, the health consequences of the climate change exacerbated California wildfires. For a class I have tomorrow, how communities subject to the most pollution from fossil fuel burning power plants now face higher COVID-19 mortality rates. So of course I'm going to say something when the same institution I am learning all of this from continues to invest in and profit off of this industry. One of the core values of the University of Nevada, Reno is integrity in all our actions. Part of the University of Nevada, Reno's vision statement is to focus on vital issues of our time and to serve as a catalyst for the betterment of our society. What's a more vital issue than the climate crisis? What's a better way to serve as a catalyst for positive change than to take direct action, joining with other leading institutions in this movement and sending a message to students, employees, and the world that the Nevada system of higher education does not support the industries that continue to harm the planet and the public. I know I don't understand all the complexities of the NSHE investment program. However, I think inherent to the word investment is a consideration about the future. Climate change is the biggest threat we face. We are already suffering the consequences, and my generation especially will continue to suffer for decades to come. I urge the committee to take immediate action towards divestment and to continue to take environmental impacts into consideration for future investments. Thank you for continuing to listen to the student voices. That is all there is for public comment for now.
Okay, thank you. Before we move to agenda item number 2 minutes, I just wanted to let the everybody on this meeting know that we will move, we will not take up agenda item number 10, operating fund distribution rate. We're going to hold a meeting on December 1st to discuss this, and I've asked Andrew and his staff to come back to this committee and eventually to the board with a series of options regarding the distribution rate and recommendations from the chancellor's office. So we won't be, I pulled that from the agenda for the discussion today. So agenda item number 2 minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
Geddes moves. Approval.
Second. Perkins.
Second.
Okay, a motion by Regent Geddes, second by Regent Perkins. Is there any discussion?
I have 2 points. Russell Campbell.
Yes.
Sorry to jump ahead there before raising my hand. A couple of items that arise from the minutes. One is Russell Investments was asked to comment on when an appropriate time to reassess their results would be. We could leave that, or they could respond in agenda item number 3, I guess. Second one for Russell Investments was they were going to provide the discussion of the risk management tools that they use. for the endowment fund. So those are two items that perhaps they could address in the next agenda item.
Okay. So is there any other or further discussion on the minutes? I have a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. So we'll move to agenda item number 3, endowment pool performance, Russell Investments. And who do we have from, we have Matt. Matt, a couple things on this item. Number one, if you could let us know what Russell's what Russell's performance has been over the last 12 months, how that compares to the benchmark, explain why Russell hasn't met the benchmark, and then explain what Russell plans to do with regard to his failure to meet the benchmark. And then the way we'll proceed with this item, I'll go to Andrew Clear to see if he has any questions of you, Matt. Then we'll go to Russell Campbell, our advisory member, for questions, and then we will open it up to questions from members of the committee, and then questions for any other regent that's attending this meeting today. So with those ground rules, Matt, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning. I hope all is well. Thanks for giving me an opportunity to come and talk to the Board of Regents about performance of the portfolio. We sent through some standard materials that talked mainly about second quarter performance, but given that you want to talk more about the longer track record, particularly what's happened over the last 12 months, I'm going to go ahead and just to kind of address that verbally, just because the materials aren't super instructive in that respect. The bottom line of what's going on is, as we look at results over the last 12 months, it comes down to a couple of key decisions on Russell's part. One was to move the portfolio towards stocks that are trading at a discount, so value stocks is the nomenclature for that. And also, we've had some overweights to foreign stocks. Again, an area that we think has been, if you will, underappreciated by the marketplace in recent years. Those trends that have been kind of in place for the better part, or those positions, have been in place for, I would say, around 18 months. They've honestly been very painful. From a relative perspective, we've underperformed the benchmark as a result of both of those. I think the stories that, or the investment rationale for both of those positions, are still very firmly in place. You're not going to see us rotate from those. Both positions, the overweight to value stocks, the underweight to U.S. stocks, we both find to be very compelling. If you look at the performance of those particular exposures or bets, if you will, over the last 12 months, they've really suffered. Foreign stocks have trailed U.S. stocks by, considerable margin. Value stocks have underperformed. I'm just going to try and give you a sense of how much these exposures have been penalized. U.S. versus non-U.S. stocks, we're talking a difference over the trailing 12 months of something close to 20% or thereabouts, 15 to 20%, whereas value stocks have underperformed by over 30% relative to their growth peers. Okay, these are big spreads. These are very atypical performance between geographies and style groups. A lot of this is being driven by what I would call a very high affinity by investors towards technology stocks in the States. If you looked at what's gone on in the marketplace, there are now 5 stocks in the United States that account for over 20% of the total market capitalization of the United States. This has happened in the past. It's a little bit unique in this tech, because in this particular sense, because it's all tech. But nevertheless, what's going on is we look at these stocks, they're very dominant, and we're talking about the Microsofts and Apples and Googles of the world, all very well-run businesses in respects, but they're trading at price multiples that are very, very expensive in our opinion, and we've not wanted to have a full weight in those stocks. And so Russell Investments portfolio managers, the underlying sub-advisors we use on your behalf, have all shied away from these stocks. And Russell's portfolio management team internally has also been of the opinion that these are not good investments on a go-forward basis. And so we've been underweight them for, like I said, the better part of 12 to 18 months. Those have been actually, in retrospect, not the right choice because those stocks have continued to power through, and they've left us behind. We've actually underperformed as a result. When I talk to my portfolio management team and say, all right, this is really ugly, this has been a difficult period for you, do you believe that we are going to see a reward to this particular position we've taken? And they still remain convinced that they will. What we've been waiting for is, and honestly, we were not anticipating COVID. As we came into 2020, Russell had been positioning the portfolio to be more value, a little bit more risk on, because we believe that at the outset of 2020, we were going to have a fairly constructive economy. And then suddenly what happened in, as we all know, in late February, early March, COVID really became an acute factor as it came to market performance, and that was very painful. We were wrong-footed in that respect because we weren't expecting the rapidity and the uniqueness of this particular market sell-off. As we went through the sell-off, we looked at the market and we said, are we still convinced in our positioning? And we said yes, because we did believe we were going to come through a recovery. The stimulus money that came from both the Federal Reserve and the federal government, we felt we're going to be able to get the economy back onto its feet. We're still working through that process right now, but our view is that we will recover, and the stocks that we're getting more exposure to in the portfolio are going to outperform. We have seen some signs of that in the month of September as kind of the rally in tech has started to fade a little bit. And honestly, as we come into 2021, if we get to a point where there is a vaccine that is put forth, that it becomes viable, it allows the economy to really more fully open up, we do believe that these positions are going to be rewarded because we're going to come back into a more traditional recovery phase. We're kind of in an atypical recovery right now, but we would get back into a more traditional recovery. And at that point in the market cycle, value stocks do extremely well. Foreign stocks will do very well because we expect global trade to recover, which is where they're more positioned to take advantage of. So long story short, this has been a difficult period of time. Our equity component of the portfolio, the multi-asset core fund, has really suffered some slings and arrows over the last 12 months, and I do apologize for that. It's not what I wanted to see occur, but like I said, we are still from an investment perspective of the opinion that these are the right positions, and though they have underperformed near-term, we believe that they will come right over the next probably 12 to 24 months. Let me stop there and make sure I go into enough detail that you want on the fuller questions.
I think that's enough detail for right now. And like I said, shortly we'll open it up for questions. Could you highlight what the underperformance is? And also, could you please, in total dollar number, tell us how much we're paying for Russell's services?
Yep. The total underperformance for the year on a trailing 12-month basis through, I'm going to give you to the month of August, end of August, if that's appropriate or if that's okay. The portfolio has delivered 3.3% absolute versus a benchmark of 8.4%, so about a 5% underperformance. That is on the outer range of our expectations, to be fair. We expect this portfolio to have what we would call as a tracking error or a difference from the benchmark in any given year of around 3%. So 5% is definitely greater than that expectation, but it is within what we would call a statistical probability of expected outcomes. Definitely on the low end, but within that practical range of potential outcomes. As to the fees that the system is paying, I'm going to go and this is in your materials. You would see it on page 25. The portfolio, and this is a calendar year basis, so this doesn't line up with the reporting period I just mentioned a moment ago, but on the calendar year 2019, so for the full 12 months, the portfolio fees were $943,000. I have a breakdown of what those are being attributable to. A portion of that, about $760,000, was for investment management fees. About $166,000 were for incentive fees. That is for primarily the hedge fund portfolio, where we had some managers that outperformed, but collectively that portfolio did underperform. And then there are some fund expenses that are related to things like audit, accounting, legal fees, and so forth and so on. So for a total of about $943,000 for the calendar year.
Thank you. Andrew, do you have any questions or comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and maybe just to follow up on some of your comments and your question, and you had looked at this, you had asked Matt about the last 12 months, and Matt, I'm looking at slide 23 and board members slide 23 in your presentation, and when you look at the portfolio since inception, and we're coming up now on almost 4 years. It'll be 4 years at the end of the year. And so when you look at the performance in total, and then as well within each one of the categories compared to the benchmark, you know, we're behind. I think we're behind in every category and obviously overall. And I think this question was asked, you know, maybe last time we met, but, you know, but when are we going to see, when are we going to see a turnaround on this? And I know in the past, I think what you've stated is, you know, Russell had positioned this portfolio for a downturn, and I know you just covered some of that, but I guess coming up on 4 years is, you know, when is this going to turn around, and, you know, how much longer should this committee wait for that turnaround?
I appreciate the point, and yes, as I look at the results, I am similarly disappointed as you are. You know, this game is not one that we win with dead certainty every time. I wish it were. But I think the thing that I would say is that what's gone on in some respects is I would break this apart is, was the portfolio strategically built in a way that was going to fulfill the objectives of the pool? And I would say, largely speaking, if you look at the benchmark, I would say yes. I think the way we arrayed the capital was appropriate, and it probably would have met the long-term objectives. Russell's implementation of that, the way we've executed on that strategic policy portfolio, clearly has fallen down. I think most of the underperformance, frankly, is due to this multi-asset core portfolio. We've had shortfalls in the hedge fund side as well. Some of that is due to some riskier debt bets that have been made by a couple of the hedge fund managers that had been investing in emerging market credit, and that has been very painful to the portfolio. The real asset portfolio, I would say, is largely in keeping with it, and the fixed income portfolio, even though you see a number that's behind, honestly, a lot of that is due to the pain that happened in first quarter. Most of the longer-term underperformance is really due to the multi-asset core portfolio as well as the hedge fund portfolio. You know, when we started the relationship with you folks, we talked about Horizon, investment horizon, and I think we've caught a relatively unique piece of a traditional investing cycle that makes us look less great than we would like it to be. I think we said at the beginning that we would expect about a 3 to 5 year horizon for relative performance to be in keeping of what we expected it to be. So we're kind of just at the beginning of that horizon, getting closer to the middle. Honestly, I think that if we don't have a meaningful recovery over the next 12 months, that will be problematic. So my expectation is that we will start to see a recovery as we come into the late part of this year, early next, and these numbers start to get better. But yes, I appreciate that we are very close to that kind of beginning of where we say, yep, are you meeting the grades that you need to? And at this point, we've not been able to accomplish what was originally hoped.
Andrew.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's all my questions at this time.
Okay. The question that I have for staff is, how long do we wait this out? What is your recommendations to the committee? Should we be looking at replacing this particular OCIO? And that would only we would only be able to do that with a recommendation from staff coming back to the committee. And the other question I would have of you before I go to Russell, how does this performance, Russell Campbell, how does this performance compare to the performance of the two large foundations that have the other piece of these endowment funds.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the on your last question relative to the other foundation. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I know the last time we presented those, I think to the full board last December, the relative performance of the Enchi endowment compared to the foundation was very close, but I don't have the specific numbers, and I don't know if Matt or Wendy have those numbers. So I think overall, relative to the, and I think there are years where the Enchi Foundation outperforms, and there are years where we underperform relative to the foundation. So I think it depends on the period of time you're looking at. To your first question, Mr. Chairman, I think it would make sense in my mind to, and I did have a conversation with Russell Campbell about this as well, and so he can certainly chime in on this as well. I think for this committee to evaluate the performance of both OCIOs, I think we would want to see performance data through the end of this calendar year. So perhaps at our first quarterly meeting next year is when we should be evaluating, you know, do we make a change with one or both of the OCIOs?
Thank you. Russell Campbell.
Thank you, Chairman. Matt, your firm has been around a long time. Have your results ever underperformed benchmarks by this much before?
No. On an individual strategy basis, you might run across a small cap fund or an emerging market fund that would have this level of underperformance over a very compressed period of time. But yeah, no, I think this is, it's not unique, but it's certainly on the upper or lower end, or however you want to describe it, of results that we've seen over this kind of window. Bear in mind, we're talking about really painful results over a 12 or 18 month period, and those are being reflected in the longer term annualized numbers. So we are talking about a relatively short period of really ugly results, but our hope is that will recover also in a relatively rapid fashion.
Okay. I listened very carefully to your explanations, and what I didn't really hear was what you're going to do differently. It seemed that you just used the word hope. You also used the word, you know, if the economic recovery doesn't take place in the next 12 to 18 months, it's going to be a difficult time. There's a lot of hope and prayer involved in this, and I would have expected that something would be happening differently in an investment organization like yours that's so large and has been around such a long time, and you have so many asset classes to choose from. You would have figured out something that would have given us hope, as opposed to, from an investment perspective, just hoping that things turn out better. And I really didn't hear much about what you're going to do differently and how you're going to, you know, even if, let's say, okay, let's go back to the 12 months. If the next 12 months don't turn out the way you expect, what then will you do differently?
No, I think it's a fair question. And I don't mean to say that we're running this portfolio emotionally or through just hope and prayer, as you say. No, these are fundamentally based decisions. We do believe very strongly that the market is heavily focused on stocks that are absurdly priced. And so we believe our portfolio has extremely good earnings for the value that you're paying for those stocks. So make no bones about it, this isn't a hope and a prayer portfolio. We actually are very convicted the stocks we hold are the right ones. And we have, you know, probably close to a dozen sub-advisors within our portfolio. And they are all very much of the opinion that the market is kind of at a point where it's the multiples you're paying are extremely high. And so you shouldn't be doing that. And so we are sticking to our guns, if you will. We believe that this is the right positioning for the portfolio. Should we have been more tactical? I think in retrospect, you would say, yeah, we should have battened down the hatches in February and tried to ride out a storm. But this investment game is not played by trying to make a great call every month. It's about setting the portfolio towards what we think are tailwinds at your back that are likely to be paid, and hopefully avoid those that we think are going to be discounted or not rewarded going forward, and that's exactly what we're doing. So, I could have said, yes, we're going to rotate towards tech stocks right now. I think that would be the exact wrong decision to be making at this point in the cycle. Unless you really truly believe that the large companies that I mentioned earlier are going to have growth rates that are frankly not sustainable at the level that they've been priced into their stocks at this stage. You know, if we were to do that, maybe it works for a couple more months as this momentum trade continues, but eventually that starts to fall apart. And I would draw your attention to a slide in the deck on page 13 on our materials that I think is illustrative of what can happen. These on page 13, show a series of stocks that were very well known and had done extraordinarily well during the 70s, the tech bubble, even the financial crisis just leading up to that. And if you look at the numbers, these are substantial drawdowns in these stocks. And if I'd said, well, I'm going to put the portfolio all into Cisco Systems or Apple or IBM, which were amazing companies just as we came into the tech bubble, they had drawdowns that were north of 60 to 70%. That's how much they sold off by. Mm-hmm. So I would rather not face that type of price decline just as we're coming to the end of probably a real halcyon period for these tech companies. I think it would be not a wise investment decision to do that. So long story short, we're sticking with our decisions. We believe they are the right ones fundamentally. Our CEO has repeated this to us over the last couple of months, that they are still very confirmed or convicted in these bets or these exposures. Sorry, I don't mean to put it pejoratively.
I'm going to say a little aside, because this is really an inside baseball comment, but I note that the managers that you've been selecting or the adding money to have been doing well. And that seems at odds with how most people manage portfolios. Typically, you hire all the managers are great in every category. But, you know, based on market conditions, some managers do better than others. And typically what you do is rebalance to the ones that aren't doing so well. In fact, in the last quarter, just to take an example, you've been adding to the managers who have been doing well. So you just said you don't want to get into momentum. You don't want to be changing. And yet you're sort of going along with the momentum and reinvesting in the things that have been doing well. It's an inside baseball question. If you could give me just a really short answer to that, that would be great.
Would you mind telling me which managers you're referring to? Because that actually is opposite of what our managers, internal our portfolio management
team typically. There were four managers on page 49, your slide 49. There are four managers.
Okay. I'm looking through the comments here.
I think there was a growth manager.
So bear in mind, we added to these managers at the end of March in anticipation of markets that sold off so severely at late March. We actually overweighted equities and we overweighted high yield debt as we came into late March, because the oversoldness, if you will, or the penalty that had been assigned was so severe, we wanted to actually do that, and we deployed capital to those things that had actually done the worst. And they actually were rewarded as we came into second quarter. So just want to make sure I frame that correctly for you there.
Okay. My last question is, if we're not doing well, chances are the rest of your clients are not doing well either, I would hope. what's the response of your other clients? Are you losing business at this time?
Actually, we're not. Our clients have been confident and stayed with us. Yes, I've had the same conversation with pretty much all of my clientele that use these set of products. And I think, again, it comes down to thinking about the proper investment horizon, or what the horizon you want to use by which to judge success and failure by. And I would say 1 year is too short. 3 years, we're getting close to that appropriateness. 5 years, obviously, kind of the ideal time frame.
Sure.
But we've dug a pretty big hole and over a very short amount of time, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And so this is a significant front-of-mind question for investment staff at this stage. So I don't want to leave anyone on the board with the impression that we are taking this lightly. This is going to job one right now.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you. I was trying to find my mute button. Do we have any questions from members of the committee? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think Russell covered a lot of ground for us, so I don't have any additional questions.
Okay. Thanks, Regent Hayes. Any other questions from members of the committee? Questions from other regions who are on the call? I'm sorry?
Actually, Mr. Chair, just Regent Hayes said, yes, Mr. Campbell did an excellent job of asking some of the questions that I thought of myself. What would trigger a change in the investment style? Earlier you said that you're sticking to your guns and that you're going to maintain this particular course. So what would happen to trigger a change in your course?
No, that's a good question, Regent Perkins. I think it really comes down to if we were to see kind of a change in fiscal and monetary stimulus. Right now, we've gone through a phase where we needed that kind of support by the system, if you will, and that's been beneficial. It's gotten us through kind of a tough period in the economy. Our expectation is that stimulus will continue, and as it does, it allows some of the more what I would call cyclical segments of the marketplace, industrials, materials, manufacturing, a little bit to some extent healthcare, to get back on their feet. Those are the areas that we have overweights in, and we believe that as the economy reopens, those are going to be the segments that are right now underpriced, and they will actually outperform. If we were to see a huge resurgence in COVID, where the economy has to get locked down again, that would probably be something that would cause us to revisit whether or not we want to be as aggressive in our risk positioning as we have been, because as we all recall, it was a very difficult period in March and April for financial markets and the economy. And so I think there is maybe a lesson to be learned that this particular episode is one that don't want to have that same level of impact on the portfolio, and so we would be much more quicker to the mark to kind of change course, if you will. Is that helpful?
Thank you. Yes.
Wonderful.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if you wouldn't mind, there was a question that was asked early on and I did not address. Mr. Campbell had asked about risk tools, and I had sent through to staff a couple of slides that discussed the risk tools that Russell uses in terms of portfolio construction. They're very detailed. I'd be happy to do a call with Mr. Campbell later to walk through those if that would be appropriate.
I'm game. Thanks.
Okay, great. I'll send you an email at some point here in the next week.
Okay, I think that would be helpful. Thank you. Okay, we'll move to agenda item number 4, Endowment Pool Performance, Cambridge Associates. Wendy, are you on the call? Hello? I think you're on mute.
Yeah.
You're still on mute, Wendy.
Yes, that's my trick. Hello, good morning, everybody. Pleased to be here.
Okay.
Can you hear me now?
We can. The floor is yours. We'll follow
okay,
the same
super.
Procedures before. If you could highlight the difference between the benchmark and the performance over the last 12 months, and then if you could also give us an idea of any adjustments you think are appropriate, and finally, if you could give us in total dollar a number, how much, what the total fees are that the system is paying to Cambridge. And with that, the floor is yours.
Certainly. So I just looked up the trailing 12 months return through August 31st. The Cambridge portfolio delivered an 8.8% return. That's 10 basis points ahead of the policy benchmark. I should note that these numbers are preliminary since we still are awaiting June 30th private investment results. Right now, our private investment results are still as of March 31st because those managers report on a lag. And therefore, after those results are reported, these numbers would go up. I should also note that our 10 basis point outperformance of the benchmark is understated because up until this point, we have been self-benchmarking the private investment portfolio. We now view the private investments portfolio as sufficiently mature to switch to the initial plan, which was at the end of 5 years, we would switch to a market-based benchmark, and we're actually recommending with some proposed handbook edits to switch that benchmark today, because happily the private investment portfolio has emerged from the J curve earlier than expected and has been driving, you know, very meaningfully strong returns. Page 12 of our discussion materials also shows our performance over various longer time periods. For the calendar year to date, we are outperforming our benchmark by 50 basis points. When we go back to March 2017, which was the start of our formal track record after an initial transition period, we are still slightly lagging our benchmark by 30 basis points. But again, this is, we think that underperformance is being distorted by the absence of our true long-term benchmark for the private investment results that we're proposing to move forward with. Our only recommendation, our recommendations are already reflected in the benchmark. The benchmark change that I just mentioned, which is just accelerating the planned benchmark change that we laid out initially upon working together. And we have recently re-underwritten the real assets part of our portfolio and exited master limited partnerships. That's on a strategic basis. You know, we internally have been confronting many of the same headwinds that Matt has described. I wouldn't disagree with any of those market forces that have been very difficult to navigate. It has prompted us to do a great deal of re-underwriting because, as John Maynard Keynes famously said, the markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. So there's certain areas, and I would characterize MLPs as a value-oriented investor. It broke my heart to terminate our MLP manager because valuations were so compelling. But after the sort of volatility that we experienced with their worst performance in history in the first quarter, followed by their best performance in history in the second quarter, after that rebound in the second quarter, we decided to, just exit the position. It's something where we still believe fundamentally it should work, but the fact that the market sentiment has been so divergent from what we view, from our views on a fundamental basis, it sort of highlights for us our need to be somewhat humble about some of these things and frankly, acknowledge that there may have been something that we're not seeing, that the market is seeing to lead to some of the price volatility. So that's just one example of some of the recent changes that we've made, and then just a slight adjustment in our policy benchmark just to reflect that strategic change that we've already made. We have also reflected on page we've included our the fees paid for our part of the endowment portfolio. It's on page 7 of the discussion materials. The grand total is $1.8 million. I would note that all fees and expenses are already netted out of the performance numbers that I already relayed. So, our outperformance of our benchmarks has been net of all fees and expenses. And similar to Matt Beardsley's commentary, this fees analysis is for calendar year 2019.
Thank you. Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any specific questions, but maybe to orient the committee a little bit, on page 12 of the agenda item number 4, so it's material 4A, on page 12 of that, it lists for the committee the total endowment. It breaks it down between Cambridge and Russell, and you can see the annualized amount since March of 2017 is highlighted with a green border. The fiscal year to date column through June, you can see that as well. And so if you look at the total endowment fiscal year to date, down 3%, Cambridge up 0.1%. And Mr. Chairman, you had asked me earlier about how does this compare to the foundations. I received an email from Lori McClanahan over at the UNR Foundation, And she indicated that fiscal year to date, so that would be the relative to the column just left of the green box, that fiscal year to date ended June 30th, their return was 0.18. So that would compare to our overall loss of 3% and compare to Cambridge's 0.1 and Russell's minus 4. So just for reference.
And also, could you put in perspective, both for the record and for all that are on this call today, the total dollars that are managed by the system and the total dollars that are managed by the foundations, like the UNR Foundation, UNLV Foundation? How do those compare?
So you can see, again, on page, looking at that same page 12, you can see the total INSHE endowment, $245 million. And, Mr. Chairman, again, I apologize. I don't have in front of me the numbers for the foundations, but I can probably get those before the meeting is over.
Great, thanks. Russell, questions?
First comment I wanted to make was we had asked the both OCIOs to canvass their investment managers and figure out what they're doing with respect to climate change. And both managers provide a report, so I just wanted to mention that they did provide that. Just a question to Cambridge about that is they've committed $24 million to private investments. Of this amount, $5 million has gone to private natural resources. It's not clear to me how much of that is in energy, if any.
I'm happy to call that up for you, but these are largely sustainable private natural resources. We have not. It's been a good 2 years since our firm has sort of re-underwritten the private oil and gas space. So we're a little bit leery of that sector on a purely risk return profile type analysis. Not on the basis of.
Okay, I just want to bring it up for the committee. Given our discussions over recent years, and given that we're moving in a certain direction, it may behoove the committee to suggest that Cambridge not fund any more energy investments, traditional energy.
Well, and I just want to clarify because I just got this up. So we did make one commitment back in 2016, and we have not made any oil and gas commitments since. I guess that would have been right. It was a 2016 fund, but it would have been right at the very beginning of our mandate. And then subsequent to our recent follow-up discussions, just knowing those values that have been expressed by different community members combined with our assessment of the risk return profile of that sector, we have avoided making new commitments. We think that there are a lot of other areas, even if our research team looked favorably upon an oil and gas private manager, we would probably be unlikely to put that into the system portfolio simply because we customize portfolios for everyone.
Okay. And then my last question is, I hesitate to bring this up, but you guys lay it out there, so I have to bring it up. On page 25 or slide 25 of the Cambridge package, you have a table and it shows a long-term expected alpha or an outperformance of the policy benchmark that you guys anticipate of 120 basis points or 1.2% per year in the long run. And my question is, we haven't seen it in the last 4 years. When will we start seeing this? And these questions are quite facetious because I don't think you shouldn't really put that out there. By having such an aggressive alpha target, outperformance target, particularly, given the performance we've been looking at.
Right. Well, the one of the primary drivers of that outperformance target is our allocation to private investments. And that alpha target is basically a weighted average of our track record of alpha. And typically, our private investments programs add 300 to 500 basis points over multiple time periods over their public market cost of capital. So you know, this is something we have delivered, and the fact that our benchmark currently, we haven't switched over. Right now, we have been self-benchmarking our private investment portfolios, which have delivered very, very strong returns. So since we're self-benchmarking those, our, you know, our 10 basis points of outperformance over the past 12 months has been understated, since we are self-benchmarking the part of the portfolio that has delivered the highest return. We still feel confident in that long-term alpha target.
I think if you were presenting this to a retail investor, I think the regulators would slap your hands because you're making promises that you really can't make. So it's, I personally think it's inappropriate, but more importantly, we haven't seen it in 4 years. We haven't seen any of it. What you're suggesting now is that you're going to make it all up because you're going to re-rate all of your private equity investments. We'll see. We'll see if at the end of the year or early next year, if all of a sudden you're 120 basis points ahead of the policy benchmark. But we'll see.
Yeah, and this is over the long term, but as context, if we look at page 34 of our discussion materials, our private investment programs have delivered significant value add, and this is our legacy private investment portfolio, which were, you know, recommendations that Cambridge made over the years before we were OCIO. But over the very long term, our private investments program delivered an 11.6% return. And that's compared, if these cash flows were invested in public markets, it would have been a less than 5% return. I'm happy to take out that alpha target. You know, that was something that we had presented to the committee when we were first proposing to work together under this OCIO model. But, you know, we're happy to take it out if you're not comfortable with it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Over to you.
Okay. Do we have any questions from members of the committee? Indeed. Okay, so let's move now to agenda item number 5. This is an action item, operating pool performance discussion and recommendations. And Wendy, this will be you and Andrew. Now we're moving, just for everybody on the call, we're moving from our endowment pool discussions to the operating pool discussion. So Andrew and Wendy, you guys have the floor and you can approach it however you think best.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I will turn it over to Wendy to give the presentation.
Sure. So this should be pretty straightforward, and in terms of performance, in that the operating fund is performing, since it's a mostly passive portfolio, we are performing in line with expectations. The asset allocation has added a little bit of value, but in general, the each composite within the portfolio has returned in line with expectations. There's not all that much to discuss. We also cite on page 6 of our materials the annual management fees that are paid on the operating fund portfolio. It's $1.33 million to outside managers. Cambridge advises this pool for a flat $50,000, which is a one basis point fee for Cambridge's advisory services. And we're roughly in line with policy benchmarks. So I will pause there on the performance discussion and asset allocation. We do also have a recommendation for this pool. It was combined in one of the requested items around racial equity investing, which were in the, we grouped all the requested items in our endowment materials. So I'll wait for your direction on when you'd like us to address that racial equity investing section and that manager recommendation.
Okay, two things, Wendy. The first of all, this is an action item, and so I take it from the way the agenda item was drafted that both you and our staff are coming back to us for a recommendation for reallocation or are you recommending that we don't do a reallocation? And the second piece of that, Wendy, if you could please use this time then to discuss the item that you just raised on the racial equity investing. Thank you.
Certainly. So today we recommend no rebalancing within the operating fund. We present on page, we had supplemental materials with our updated performance, but after discussions with system staff indicated they did not wish to draw more liquidity out of the long-term pool. And within the long-term pool, we are very close to policy targets, so Cambridge has no recommended rebalancing activity. That said, we do have a new manager recommendation as part of our racial equity investing, section. And for that, I will turn it over to my colleague, EJ, who will present that section. And this is in... it's in the book, INV-4A.
And Mr. Chairman, maybe a comment before we go to that section on the question of rebalancing. And I just want to point out that, you know, based on the action that the board took on August 21st, we did move $73 million from the long-term pool into the intermediate bonds as part of that action. And so that is part of the reason why at this point we're not rebalancing, because essentially through that process we did rebalance.
Okay. And make sure that everybody's on the same page here, Andrew and Wendy. We're looking at now in this discussion on the supplemental material, the executive summary operating fund performance asset allocation, is that what we're looking at?
For the rebalancing. So you'll note that in the column for recommendations from CA and NSHE staff, there are no recommendations there.
Okay.
I think it was drafted as a potential action item, just subject to whether or not market movement in the month of September warranted any rebalancing. And okay, we felt comfortable.
I just want to make sure that we all have the same document in front of us, and that's the executive summary, starts executive summary on the supplemental materials, operating fund performance and asset allocation as of August 31st, 2020.
Correct, and there's a table on the page with an 8 on the lower right-hand corner.
Perfect, thank you. Okay, back to you, Wendy.
Certainly. So let's turn to the discussion materials, INV-4A, and I'll kick it over to my colleague, EJ, to talk us through our recommendation in this section.
Thank you, Wendy. Can you all hear me just fine?
Yeah.
We can.
Excellent. Wanted to, again, in the section 4A, start on slide 63, page 63, really as just a public service announcement to a video pre-recording webinar on social equity investing. You should have all received this invitation, but if not, please let us know. We can certainly have one delivered to you. Also, This webinar features a fireside chat with a client that Wendy and I both work with that has carved out a part of their portfolio to explicitly focus on diverse managers. And so just wanted to highlight that there, and also point out that we have in the appendix to this section a research report on racial equity investing, which addresses many of the same topics. And so wanted to give that call out there. Moving over to slide 64, here we lay out some of the systematic costs and opportunities for our economy. And just to give a sense of the magnitude, I'll call out one of the stats here, by closing by closing the racial earnings gap alone, we would create an $8 trillion economic boost in GDP by 2050. And so really just to set the stage on the type of opportunity that we have in front of us when we're speaking to racial equity investing. On page 65, the next slide, this shows the current trends in U.S. population growth and showing that the majority of the country will be people of color by 2065, which suggests that, you know, these inequities that are present are likely to become even greater or intensify over that time. And so it's a particular point of focus for us. You know, what are some of the solutions that capital allocators like ourselves are trying to address with these systematic challenges that we face? On slide 66, we list some of these common examples across a number of different areas. And you know, the recommendation that we're bringing today for the operating fund really plays into several of these areas. So I'm happy to jump right into the recommendation, starting on slide 67.
Yeah, if you could jump into those, that'd be great, and explain those that you have on page 60 for your slide 67.
That's right. So our RBC Access Capital Community Investment is a community-targeted fixed-income strategy that aims to support low and moderate income home buyers and renters, education, healthcare, and job creation, you know, in underserved communities. And so the strategy is led by Ronald Homer, who an African-American founder and chief strategist of the strategy, who has been invested in the strategy for over two decades. You know, we're recommending a $25 million investment for the operating fund, mainly for three reasons that benefit NSHEAT. One, the investment can be geographically targeted to the state of Nevada. Two, it maintains the very high credit quality that the operating portfolio currently has. And lastly, you know, we believe that this will actually enhance the performance of the operating fund. And so to my first point on page 67, at the bottom right is just an example of you know, what a type of investment would look like in the state of Nevada. And so this is Section 8 housing for seniors, for low-income seniors and disabled, you know, located directly in downtown Reno. And so just wanting to highlight how this could be geographically targeted. On jumping to slide 69, just wanting to, again, emphasize and call out the over 97% AAA credit quality for this manager, and that these are all agency guarantees as well. Moving ahead to slide 70, though there is a higher fee with this manager, we think that you're going to be compensated for that higher fee with the higher expected returns that this manager can offer. And we show that graphically there on page 70. Moving on to page 71, you can see that that Access, RBC Access, had its largest drawdown of about 3%, while Wells Short Duration had its largest drawdown of about 1%. And because of the slightly higher volatility profile for RBC Access, we're recommending only a $25 million commitment to be sourced from the Wells Short Duration strategy as a complement for the existing exposure that we have. And so I'll pause there for any questions or discussion or a vote.
The Andrew and Russell, I'll go to you two first for any questions or comments that you have so far.
None for me so far.
Okay.
Of course, I have a comment. I'm the investment guy, but the money is being managed for a purpose. And what I wanted to remind the committee is that ENGIE has supported many diversity and inclusion initiatives with a particular emphasis, however, on education. And so I think the racial equity line is a good idea because I think it's much stronger than diversity or inclusion. But what I'd encourage the committee to consider, and frankly the whole board to consider, is funding racial equity initiatives. Rather than doing it indirectly through mortgages, why not do things that are more direct and more impactful? You know, we only have so much money and so much money available for these kinds of things. Why not do things that are consistent with the ENGIE mission? So that's my first sort of general comment. Second is the track record that was presented to us had a very odd time presented, and that was 12 years. And I thought, what happened 12 years ago? Well, 12 years ago was the Great Recession. And what would be interesting to me is to see the track record prior to the Great Recession, because the Great Recession in 2008 devastated the mortgage markets. And my concern is, I think credit risk is heightened these days. I think it's going to be very difficult for people to pay their mortgages. I think it's going to be a more difficult environment going forward, and perhaps it's going to repeat the 2008 experience. And so I'd be interested to see how that was handled 12 years ago, prior to the track record that's been offered to us.
Certainly, good comment, and would certainly be willing to provide that data, to circle back to provide that data pre-2008.
Well, I would also like to point out, though, that we do on page 81, the reason that we're using an eight-year track record is because we are indeed capturing that meltdown from late 2008. So it was precisely to show a full market cycle. And so on page 81, you'll see that that RBC Access in the year 2008 generated a 3.2% return. So it's completely insulated from the type of mortgage meltdown that you talked about. And just to reiterate, all of these loans are agency backed. So about a third of the portfolio has the explicit full faith and credit of the U.S. government behind it because they are Ginnie Mae or Small Business Administration loans. Almost another two-thirds of the portfolio are in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which have been under conservatorship of the U.S. government, and therefore they're the implicit full faith and credit of the U.S. government. So if any of these loans default, the U.S. government has and will step in to make the investor whole for these.
Wendy and Andrew, I have a question for the two of you. I see this on page, I think it was 67 of the supplemental materials that were provided. My question is, are you recommending this board approved the change from, I believe it is, the Wells Asset Management to the RBC Global Asset Management? It was page 68. Is that what your recommendation is to the
The recommendation is it's summarized on page 62 of our initial materials. It's just $25 million. The Wells cap short duration has $200 million. We're recommending pulling out $25 million out of that.
And so, what you're looking from this committee as a recommendation from the board would be the action taken would be to not do any further rebalancing of the operating pool portfolio at this time, but that we pull out $25 million to invest in the racial equity initiatives that we've just been discussing.
Right, to invest in this particular strategy, the RBC Access Community Investing Strategy. And one more point about the opportunities to customize, to Russell's good point, they do allow tilting the portfolio towards particular initiatives. So it could be tilted towards education initiatives if the system was interested in that. We also have a number of education managers that we always look at. Those tend to be early stage education technology managers that have a much higher risk return profile. So far, we haven't put any of those in the endowment portfolio, and we don't think that the risk that risk profile would be appropriate for the operating fund. But given the very, very stable return profile and the government backing of these securities, we felt that it was easily additive to the operating fund.
Okay. So with that, before we lose that train of thought, do I have a motion from members of the any member of the committee to keep the asset allocation that we have in the operating fund as is today, but that we take $25 million out of that long-term fund to be invested in the programs that we just discussed?
So moved.
Who is that?
Regent Hayes.
Regent Hayes.
If I could offer a friend, could I offer a friendly amendment that it's being pulled out of the intermediate term fund? And since this Wells short duration strategy is held in the intermediate term fund.
Oh, I think that's a great idea because I misspoke. So it'll be coming out, the $25 million comes out of the intermediate fund. Trev, is that okay with you?
That's exactly what I meant.
Do I have a second?
I'll second that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so Regent Perkins, second. Is there any discussion or are there any further questions of anybody on this agenda item? Seeing none, we have a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Passes unanimously. Thank you very much. I'm glad that we're moving in this direction. Okay, we'll move now to agenda item number 6, handbook revision statement of investment objectives and policies for the endowment fund for possible action. Andrew.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, what's requested in the handbook revisions, and Wendy mentioned this earlier, this is a request to change the benchmark for the private investments. And I know Wendy had included this in her presentation, and I don't know if Wendy has more to add on this, so I'll defer to her.
No, not really, just my prior commentary, nothing else to add.
Do we have any questions of either Andrew or Wendy on this? Okay, seeing none. Do I have a motion to approve the revisions requested in agenda item number 6?
Bendy's move approval.
Second?
Second.
Regent Hayes, second. Any further discussion or questions? Seeing none, we'll call a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, that passes unanimously. Let's move now to agenda item number 7, endowment distribution rate and policy. This also is an action item. Andrew.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The board is required to review and potentially change the distribution rate from the endowment pool. That net rate right now is 4.5%, and based on my review, it hasn't been changed in a number of years, and we are not at this time recommending a change, but this is something that the board can review and certainly change if there was a desire to. I know Wendy has included in her materials some information on distribution rates as well, and Mr. Chairman, if you would like her to go through that, I'm sure she'd be happy to.
Okay, and I would. But before we go to you, Wendy, my question is, this only applies to the endowment pool that is managed by the system, not by the foundations themselves, correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
And what is the distribution from the UNR, UNLV foundations, as an example, the two largest of the foundations?
I would have to check with them. I'm not sure what their distribution rates are.
Okay, if you could provide that to all of the members of the committee, in addition to the previous question I had, that you're getting that information from the larger foundations, that would be great. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I did receive information. So you had asked previously the Inchi Endowment relative to the other foundations, and I did receive that information. So the UNR Foundation, and let me find the email here real quick, is $232 million. The UNLV Foundation is $251 million, and I did get, I previously got the net return from UNR, and I stated that was 1.18. The UNLV Foundation for the period ending 6/30 of this year was 4.36%.
I think we need to have an explanation from both of those foundations so that at our next meeting we have a little more information so we can examine that and discuss that, if that would be okay.
Okay.
Great. Okay, Wendy.
Sure. And you know, I just called up our comparison. Each year we do, late in the year, a comparison between the system endowment and the two largest foundations. And so just referring to that document from last year, it looks like UNLV Foundation has a target payout rate of 3.5% plus a 1.35% management fee. And then for UN Reno, as it was reported almost a year ago, that was 4.5% with a 0.6% management fee.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll conduct that same exercise because we are still in the process of finalizing the June 30th performance numbers, since not all the private investment managers have reported yet. So we will be coordinating that for the next meeting.
And before you start, Wendy, Andrew, if you could make sure that in the presentations, all of the foundation presentations that are made to the board in December at our December meeting, make sure that that's highlighted what the distributions are from the each of the foundations. That would be, I think it'd be very helpful for the board.
Yeah, we will update that comparison chart.
Perfect. Thank you. Wendy, sorry.
Certainly. So those who have been on the committee for a while will find our presentation repetitive. I'm in our initial investment committee, the endowment materials, INV 4A. And I'll start off on page 44, which shows, you know, basically over the very long term, the endowment payouts for all of our peer group. We have about 400 endowment clients, and it's averaged 4.8% over the past 10 years. Right now, the system's current all-in distribution rate is 4.625, so slightly more conservative than that. And looking on page 44, you're, you know, right within the most common payout, which is somewhere between 4.5 and 5 the pie chart on the left with the magenta and green colors. Page 45 again shows that year over year, most institutions maintain their spending rate consistent. But of those who have reevaluated over the past 5 years, there are more who are decreasing their spending rate than increasing. And folks may recall that several years ago, the system did decrease its spending rate. So it's one of these numbers captured here on page 45. We also conducted a mini survey recently on how institutions are dealing with the uncertainty for fiscal year 2021. I would caution that this data is largely relevant for college and university clients that have a higher level of unrestricted assets than the NG endowment, where some of them are paying out more than their target spending rate for fiscal year 2021. But you know, obviously, given all the pressures from COVID on school operations and financial results, there's a great deal of uncertainty. I will skip ahead to page 49, which just shows, it kind of gives some forward-looking anticipation of what institutions are thinking about if they are considering a change to their spending policy. It's a pretty small subset that are, but slightly tilted towards institutions thinking to decrease their spending rate. And then page 50, I know this is a favorite slide of Regent Hayes, so we made sure to update it. This slide really looks at hypothetically what happens when we increase or decrease the spending rate. So right now, the spending rate on an all-in basis is 4.625. And the, you know, sort of counterintuitively, by increasing or by decreasing the spending rate over the very long run, by allowing the corpus to grow more, there will be more dollars to distribute. And over the very long run, there are as a higher annual payout rate. That said, it comes at the expense of spending over the short run, and clearly many institutions are facing very, very severe budget challenges this year. So that, we appreciate that fiduciaries are needing to consider very carefully. I'll pause there.
So, Wendy, what is your recommendation to us as the committee, that we leave it at 4.5%? Or that we make an adjustment in light of all of the changes that we're being confronted with today?
Well, candidly, I think that the spending rate is really outside of our purview as the investment advisor. There's so many operating and financial considerations that go into that decision, and it's going to be specific to each institution. What I would say is that based on our data and based on our long-term projections, your current spending rate is sustainable and prudent.
Okay. Andrew, do you have any recommendations to change, or should we leave it the same, which is the action that's being requested of this committee today?
Mr. Chairman, my recommendation is to not change the rate, to leave it as is, and in you know, reviewing the data compared to the foundations, it is very much in line with their distribution rates as well.
Okay. Dr. Giddings.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I would move that we maintain the rate as is.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Regent Perkins. Before we bring it up for a vote, I have a question of Russell, and then any questions from members of the committee or comments from members of the committee. Russell.
Russell Campbell, I presume?
Yes.
Who yours? Okay.
How about Russ? Does that work?
I can give you some reasons why you should consider.
Ooh, Russ, am I the only one who doesn't hear Russ?
Nope, he froze.
Yeah, he froze.
Ooh, we lost him. Let's give him one. Russ, we lost you. Are you back?
Yes, I'm back, if you can hear me.
Yes, we can now.
So I can give you some reasons, but what I'd suggest is continue to monitor this, review it again at the next meeting, But this is a very difficult decision. It's a very sticky number. It's easy to increase this number. It's very hard to reduce it, because my understanding is most of this distribution goes to fund scholarships. And that's, to cut the rate means you have less money for scholarships. And I realize that's very difficult to do. But there are some investment reasons why you might want to consider that, but maybe now is not the time.
So when you see our next meeting in December that we schedule, or next year. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Richard, Mr. Tate.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping Russell was going to give me a nice lead in there and explain the good reasons why we should consider lowering it. But I think he actually talked me into supporting the motion and staying where we're at and revisiting it another year. But those of you that have been on the investment committee for a few years know, and as Wendy pointed out on the slide 50, I'm always in favor of a slightly lowering, whether it's to 4.25 or 4.0. As you can just see, the amount of money we would have to give. Now, this goes back to 1930, but in a short period of time, 5 to 10 years, we would be giving more money and having more money saved than we're giving now. And I think that short-term hit would have been a great idea when I first brought this up a few years ago. But as Russell Campbell pointed out, now is probably not the time. So I do hope those of you that are still on the committee next year, if we are in a better position, we'll consider doing that. If you look at the slide Wendy has on page 45, was it? Where did it go? There was the one, oh, it's 44, that the 4 to 4.49 gets 31% of the colleges and universities. That's a pretty good number. It's equivalent to those that have 5. We're in the middle. But I think that with us not having billions and billions and being able to increase our asset, we will have more to give, and it'll continue to give back more. So I would encourage the board to really strongly consider that next year. But we do need the money right now, so I will support the motion.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Regent Geddes?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say I think we should have it on the December agenda item. I recall when we were going through the recession, we dipped into negative territory and we were allocating, and then reactionarily we started adjusting the rate downwards. But I think it's something in this market that we should at least take a look at it at every investment meeting, even if the action is to keep it the same. But if we have to make an adjustment, we can do so.
And I would suggest, Andrew, that we have some data and recommendations from the Chancellor's office, so that when we discuss something, we have our options in front of us so we can make an informed decision. Any other questions or comments? Here we have a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye. This is on agenda item number 7, to leave the rate at the 4.5%. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes unanimously. Okay, we'll move now to agenda item
number. Can I ask a quick clarifying question of Regent Geddes? I wonder if the what you're referring to back in the global financial crisis, which predates my involvement with the system, was that, I'm wondering if that sounds like more like the spending rate out of the operating fund. Did you also want to revisit it for the endowment at the December meeting? I wasn't aware that it had endowment had changed.
You're correct, Wendy. I meant the operating funds is something that we should put on standing. Sorry. Thank you for fixing my error.
Yeah. No. Great. Thanks.
That's why we have all these experts. Okay, we'll move to agenda item number 8, which is for information only, bank financial services contracts. Andrew.
Mr. Chairman, if Rhett Vertrese is on, my assistant CFO, he was going to present this item today.
Okay.
Yes, I am on. Can you hear me?
We can.
You can. Okay. Let's see, I'll go on to video as well. Well, good morning, members of the board. My name is Rhett Vertrese, for the record. I've been asked to provide this update on NSCG's banking service agreements. The pandemic has slowed but not stopped the processes to complete these solicitations. There are three distinctive services that we have been working on over the last year in process. There are the banking and treasury management services, the merchant and payment gateway services, and the procurement card services. Working groups have been formed for each of these services with representatives from the system administration and every NFHE institution. The working groups will oversee the request for proposal process for these services. The charter of the working groups include identifying the desired features, functionality, and service delivery requirements capable of meeting both standardized NFHE-wide functionality and additional functionality to address unique needs that we may have going forward. It's also to establish realistic timelines for the solicitation, award, and implementation processes. They help with authorizing the RFP scope of work, which includes the design and evaluation process, establishment of criteria and weightings. They administer a fair and competitive solicitation process, which is key. And at the end, they recommend award to the successful bidders, and they champion the RFP process and implementation to secure the success of the award and the service provider changes. So each of the services are in different stages of the RFP process, and I'll go through each one of them one by one. Banking and Treasury Management Services, which has been in place since 2007, are the furthest along. An award was recently completed and a new vendor was selected. Wells Fargo Merchant Services is potentially going to be our new partner. We're currently under contract negotiation with them and in the discovery stages of the changeover process. The transition will take 2 to 6 months to complete, is what we're estimating, and we're at the very beginning of that. The second process is merchant. The second RFP will be merchant and payment gateway services. So these services are being solicited together. Merchant services provides for processing of payments to NFHE institutions via credit and charge cards. The agreement is currently held by Wells Fargo Merchant Services and has been in place since 2013. Payment gateway services provide the acceptance of credit card and e-check and ACH payments through a portal hosted by TouchNet, our current vendor. That relationship has been in place since 2010. The working group is currently developing criteria for the RFP, and the goal is to have a new contract in place by December 2021. Payment card services, or procurement card services. They provide the purchasing of goods and services by NSHE institutions via credit cards. The working group has drafted an RFP, but was unable to complete the solicitation process this year. The contract for services expires tomorrow, September 30th, 2020. We've renegotiated a one-year renewal, extending the contract until September 30th, 2021, with the provision for cancellation upon 30 days notice. The goal is to have a new contract in place by September 30th, 2021. That concludes my review. Are there any questions?
Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Rhett, just to be clear, these would apply to every NSCG institution and we all use the same services, correct?
That is correct, yes.
And are there exceptions for other departments, foundations, yeah, athletics, or what exceptions are out there?
Yes, yeah, so I mean, there's other departments that use some of these services directly with these vendors. So TouchNet will provide, say, additional services to certain departments within our student financial area generally to help with those processing. But they're minimal. There's not a lot of them out there. And we've looked at all those as part of this process and hope to, make sure if there are other agreements that we could abide by those terms as part of this process as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Hey, Britt, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm sorry. This is Regent Carvalho. I did have a question, if that's okay.
Sure.
I was just curious to know on these RFPs how long the term of these contracts will be for.
So board policy dictates that our banking and service contracts are 5 years with a maximum of 2 1-year extension.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll move to our last agenda item, not the last, but the agenda item number 9. This is also for information only, charge of the investment committee. Andrew.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Title I, Article 7, Section 3, lays out the charge of the investment committee, and there are three items listed in there, and it's contained in your backup material, so I won't read it to you. Bring this to the committee just for your review and input if there are desired changes or if there are changes that the committee wants to make. If you can direct staff, and we can bring those back to a future meeting for an action item. You certainly don't have to change the charge, but just bring it before the committee for your review.
Is there any recommendations or suggestions from members of the committee? Okay, seeing none, we'll move now to agenda item number 11, a new business. Is there any new business? Seeing none. We'll move now to agenda item number 12, public comment. Winter, do you have any public comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is no public comment.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everybody very much for your patience and your attention on this. And this meeting is adjourned. We will our next meeting is currently scheduled, I believe, for 10 o'clock on December